Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to season finale week here on BOA Audio as we wrap up season 8 of the program with two episodes tonight, or today I should say, with our good friend Adam Davies, and then Thursday night with David Paulides. And today, folks, we're breaking the rules a bit on BOA Audio. We usually don't have a guest on twice in one season unless it's something very special, something very groundbreaking. And that's what we're doing here, not only on this program, but also as part of the season finale week. Adam Davies is coming back to the program. Adam, you're still with us, right? We had some difficulties there before we started the show. Adam, you're back, right?
I'm here. I'm good. I'm glad to be here.
Good, good, good. As I said, we're doing something pretty big here tonight because Adam has a story that he's wanted to tell for a year and a half. He actually told me the loose outlines of it all, sort of the skeletal gist of the story back in February, and said, when the time is right, when I can share this story, I want to come on Banal of America Audio and share it with the world first. So we're getting a worldwide exclusive here on BOA Audio, and that's why we're tying it all into season finale week. This is a big, big show, folks. I think it's going to really turn a lot of heads in the Bigfoot research community and really get a lot of news going in the cryptozoology world when you hear the full story unfold. He's got a new book out. It is titled Man Beasts, A Personal Investigation, and I had the opportunity to read it over the last couple of days and enjoyed it quite a bit. And for the folks who have been listening to Adam on BOA Audio for years, you definitely want to pick up Man Beasts, A Personal Investigation, because it sort of acts as a companion to the many, many, many hours we've spent talking to Adam on the program. So with all that said, thank you, Adam, for coming on BOA Audio again. Thank you for sharing this story with us. I'm really looking forward to sharing it with the world and hearing the details of it in depth. Welcome back, my friend.
Oh, man, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's good to finally talk about this. We've been brewing this for a while, and I appreciate your integrity in keeping this story under wraps. And as you know, I agreed not to talk about this publicly until I'd been given permission by Brian Sykes to do so. That permission was granted. So here we are this evening.
Yes, very exciting stuff, very exciting stuff. And it's all contained in the book Man Beasts, A Personal Investigation. It's sort of the crescendo of a story that's unfolding slowly in the background of the book. I really like that a lot. It's sort of the underlying thread that is Bigfoot lurking in the periphery of your research career, sort of always haunting you, teasing you, calling you to come and check out the Bigfoot and look into it. And as we see it sort of unfold over the course of the book, it explodes in this series of trips to America to research the Bigfoot. So I guess give people a little thumbnail of Man Beast, A Personal Investigation, sort of sum up kind of how I just explained to the folks this Bigfoot element that's at work in the book.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think what you said encapsulates it very well. So the book initially starts with a great piece of research that I did in China with Jeff Meldrum, who wrote the foreword to the book. And we went out to investigate the Yeren, the Chinese wild man. I'd always been really interested in the stories there. And so I pitched an idea to MonsterQuest to go out and do a show there. And they were up for it. They were very, very interested. So we did that show. And while I was there, I took some time, because I was bunking with Jeff, to talk to him about the Patterson-Gimlin film. Because I'd never really explored Bigfoot. I mean, I'd been, as you know, all over the world to lots of different places. But I'd never really shown a massive interest in Bigfoot. It was a peripheral thing to me. And there were two reasons. Firstly, because I always felt it was more plausible that I would look for, if there were ape-like creatures, man-beasts in the world still in existence, I'd look for them in very remote areas, jungles like Sumatra, because that seemed more scientifically plausible. And also I'd researched those, and that was my real passion. And secondly, I wasn't sure what I could bring to the party, because there were a number of researchers. It's a vast field, this Bigfoot community. There's all sorts of people with all sorts of views. Some of them love one another. Some of them absolutely hate one another. It's a weird, weird hodgepodge.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wasn't sure whether I wanted to delve into it. You know, I thought, oh, do I need all this crap? Well, probably not. When I was with Jeff and he explained the Patterson-Gimlin film, I thought, well, this looks really convincing. He went through it frame by frame. It was at that point, I think, when I started to think, well, that's going to be something I'm going to do at some point. And, of course, I went on a number of other expeditions looking for and refining my ideas and notions about what these creatures might be, how they might behave and how they might exist. I went to Nepal. I did a film there, a two-parter there in the Himalayas, which was great. And it featured one of my friends, a producer, Jeremy Gilead, who comes along later on to the Bigfoot search. I went to Russia. I went to Sumatra. And there's some amazingly poignant moments there as well. But it was eventually they ended up. I ended up in America, as you know. And I ended up doing some of this research. And that kind of mushrooms to the end game, which was doing the research with Brian Sykes and Laurie at Laurie's site.
Hmm. All right. We got a caller already somewhere from somewhere in the world. I don't know if we should take them yet or not. So, caller, if you're waiting, we just started the program, so hold on tight. Looks like it's someone in the Oregon area. So someone – it is not Laurie, though, because I have Laurie's number here saved.
Okay,
so that was a little odd, but bear with me. So, caller, hold on tight. They must be that excited to get into the story here.
We've not even started.
I know, no kidding. They're like, I have 35 questions for you about this Dr. Sykes thing. So I guess, well, join the club, caller, because I do too, and I've been waiting a year and a half here to ask Adam all these questions, so we're going to start with that. So, Adam, let me back up a bit. Because I want to first talk about, like, it feels a bit odd in a way, and we should sort of, like, address the elephant in the room of sorts, that, you know, we're going to be talking about Dr. Sykes a lot here over the course of this conversation. So it's not only is it cool that we're invoking him into this story, because he was a part of the story, but he's cool with you doing this, and, you know, that we're not telling tales out of school here, and that we're not just sort of, like, trying to use him for any sort of advancement here. We're just sharing a story that actually really went down.
Well, no, this is my version of the story as I saw it, and Laurie will obviously have her own, and Brian will have his. But I mean, the intrinsic facts as they stand is I've known Brian for a number of years. In fact, it was in 2011 I did a talk at the CSZ on Sumatra, And after that talk, he had been debating whether he was going to launch his project. Obviously, he had a number of ideas, but he told me afterwards that he was persuaded after he saw my talk at the CSZ that it was a subject that was worthy of investigation. He had been considering it, and that was a turning point, because he thought that there were people who were doing credible research who we may be able to get plausible samples from. So on that basis, we discussed it and went through all the details. And I went down to Oxford and talked about it with him. And my original focus was on the Orang Pendek. And that was what we talked about, because that was my interest.
Right.
But after I went to the U.S. in September 2012, I told him what had happened there. And again, he was interested in the story, but he, of course, he wanted to investigate it for himself. So together with Rhett Mullins and Laurie, as part of Team Big Pathology, he went to that area. And he was impressed by what he observed. He was there thinking, well, I definitely can hear knocking. It's definitely subterranean. It's definitely not Laurie that's doing it. This is an area that's worthy of research, and we should concentrate on gathering some samples. So Brian paid for me to go out to do some research with Laurie, and hence the story, the kind of remarkable story, begun. So the three of us went and did that research. He asked me to keep it confidential until I was given permission to talk about it in my book, and that permission was subsequently granted. So here we are.
Yeah, exactly. So he's cool with this. Have you heard from him, like, since all this started to trickle out, or is he kind of – are we like the canary in the coal mine here to see what's going to happen?
Out now.
Yeah, this is it. This is it.
No, he's just tricking out now. I mean, this is the first time I've talked about it. But he did give me permission to talk about it, so here we are.
All right. So now you've been given permission to tell this story. He comes to America. He checks out this area first with Lori. Then he comes back, and he contacts you, and he wants to do this secret expedition. Why did he want to keep it secret? Just so there wasn't going to be a whole bunch of
I presume that you wouldn't want people. Yeah, you don't want people crawling all over it in the first instance. And also, he's conducting important scientific research. I mean, he's one of the world's leading geneticists. He wants to gather samples. He doesn't want people trumpeting about it. He wants it to be professional. So that's what it's all about. And it wouldn't have been appropriate to do to trumpet it at the time, because if we had gathered samples which would have validated the existence of a Bigfoot, then that would have been something that would have had to go through a scientific paper and would have needed to have passed peer review.
Hmm.
And none of that could have happened if we were singing and dancing about it. It would have been unprofessional. So that was why, basically, and that's very good reasons. I don't think you trumpet your research until after you're ready to publish the conclusions, myself. So that was where we were with it. So in that instance, and of course he'd had a direct experience because he'd been with Laurie and Rhett over to that area, and it had intrigued him enough to want to pay for me to come.
All right, sounds good. Now we got Laurie here. We got Laurie on the line now, so let's bring her aboard the ship here. What's going on, Laurie? Thanks
Hello.
For calling into BOA Audio.
Thank you so much for having me on your show, Tim. Hi, Adam.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Hi, Laurie.
As I was telling Adam, I feel bad because I kind of just centered this around Adam because he's such a longtime friend of the show and everything. And then as I got more into the story of this expedition and everything, I realized how huge a role you played in this. This was really sort of like the three amigos of, like, you and Dr. Sykes and Adam. So it's like,
yeah.
the only guy we're missing is Brian Sykes. So if he wants to call in,
is Brian.
We'd be happy to have him.
I know.
Tonight,
he needs to call in.
So Adam kind of, I don't know if you've been listening at all, but Adam set the stage for how this expedition sort of came about. But I was intrigued by... Well, I guess let's start out. This is all really haphazard because we've known Adam forever, so I really just jumped in without even introducing Adam very well and telling folks about Extreme Expeditions, his previous book, how he's traveled all over the world looking at these various cryptids, the Almasti, the Mwakele Mamembe. He's practically got a dual citizenship in Sumatra because he's been down there so often looking for the Orang Pendek. it's really kind of...
But not for the food, Tim.
Yeah,
not for the food.
Yeah, not for the food. So I feel bad in a way because for the folks who are listening maybe for the first time ever, they're like, what is going on here with these guys? This is just like two guys sitting in a pub. But that's what it is when Adam and I get together. So for those newcomers,
yeah, absolutely.
That's sort of
Adam's on your show like once a year, right?
Adam is a fixture of the program at this point.
Yes.
I'm one of the biggest Adam Davies fans around. I'm actually, as we joked about earlier, I mentioned in the book for giving him a disturbing wake-up call at one point, which we'll get to at some point in this conversation. But to circle it all back around, Laurie, introduce yourself to the BOA Audio listeners. Tell us a little bit about you. Tell us about your dad's research and sort of shade the background here of this story and how, your contributions to this epic
Absolutely.
Tale.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, I'm Laurie Simmons. I am co-author of my father's book, Tracking Bigfoot, And soon I will have the continuance of that book called Tracking Bigfoot, The Journey Continues. And actually, I wasn't a Bigfoot believer until after my father passed away back in 2010. And it was my father's dying wish that his book to be published and that the world does know the truth, that they do exist. My father lived in a small knit town in Marble Mount. It's based in the North Cascade Mountains, and he lived there for 30 years, and he would come across tracks and signs of Bigfoot living up there, and he started tracking Bigfoot for 28 years from the time he came across a Bigfoot print with his brother when he was hunting. And so my father, he lived completely off the grid. He lived off the land, and he discovered while he lived in the Cascade Mountains that these Squatches, the Bigfoots, lived in either direction of his home. And truly amazing. And his book, Tracking Bigfoot, is his journal. And so the book that I wrote, The Journey Continues, is my journal, bringing Adam and other people that I've brought with credentials to my father's location to help me finish my father's research, because unfortunately he passed away. He lost his battle to cancer before he could continue on with his research. And so that's where we started the Big Guy Project with Adam and Professor Brian Sykes, is with Professor Brian Sykes' skills, his scientific skills, and Adam's research knowledge, field research knowledge, and my knowledge of their behavior patterns that I've studied since 2010, I brought that to the table, and we collaborated our skills and formed these just strategies and how we can obtain DNA on our project. And it's truly amazing. It was a one-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and my father always wanted a scientist to take him seriously, this mountain man, to study an apple that was eaten by a possible Bigfoot, to him. And I was able to do that for him, so it's really nice. It truly was a lifetime experience for me.
It sounds remarkable, and what I thought was interesting in the book, which I don't know if I fully grasped it when I originally talked to Adam about his first journey to America, when the strange picture incident, that original expedition, I didn't realize really until I read Man Beast that you have quite the communal relationship with these Bigfoot that are in the area. It sounds like it's really unique. I mean, you know, there are folks out there. There's strange folks out there who claim that they commune with the Bigfoot. 95% to 99% of them are either crazy or lying. Based on the information I've received so far in the book and the people that are working with you, I'm willing to put you in the 1% of people who may very well be in some kind of habituation with the Bigfoot, because it sounds like you really seem to have this thing. Seem to have some kind of connection
I have a connection. It's truly amazing. They recognize my voice whenever I'm in the area. They know it's me. It's truly amazing.
The point I'd make about that is because it's a very good one. A number of people who are claiming this, and this was always the danger when I first approached it, is, you know, how plausible are the people who are claiming to have any connection with Bigfoot? Because I can't see how that would actually work. But what you had in this particular instance with Laurie, what I was trying to do was bring a number of witnesses, not just my opinion, because my opinion's one opinion.
Right.
So I had not just friends, I had people who were like film producers, I had people I'd never met before, a dentist turned up, you know, and then
absolutely,
you know, credible science. And we'll talk about that story later because I think it's quite funny, if that's all right. But we had, you know, and then you have credible scientists who are prepared to do this research as well and draw their own conclusions about what might be there and have their own experiences. So it's a culmination of people. It's not just people who just want to believe that there's a Bigfoot there. And I understand that I can have my own particular bias. So I'm not objective if I want to find the existence of these things. You become an advocate, and there's a difference between being a researcher and being an advocate, and you have to be very careful about that. But any research that we've gathered, so for example, with Sykes, and any of the research that I've done historically, is analysed objectively by credible scientists. So I can say, well, look, this is what I observed, this is what I thought. But then ultimately that research is handed over to people who are objective and who will do that research and who will draw their own objective conclusions, and that's what you're after. So thoughts, feelings and experiences, and what, you know, the uniqueness of Laurie's research is, as Laurie said, it was built up from 28 years of her dad's research, then her own research, and then all these other people who've been involved very recently who have no connection with Laurie and have drawn their own positive conclusions about the work.
Exactly. It's not just you and Laurie sitting around a campfire saying that these things are happening. It's
no,
there have been multiple people.
No,
yeah,
right.
The question I have to sort of paint a picture of the situation here and what's going down, and either one of you can answer this, but perhaps Laurie best. When we first talked to Adam about the original American expedition, you were very reticent to say specifics about the location. And then in the book, you say Marble Creek, which to me that could be in England for all I know, because I don't really know geography of Oregon. So it could be huge, it could be small. How much do we know about this area that you guys have been looking at? Is it like a secret location, or is it someplace that people could know about now that you're telling the story more? And is there a danger? We really don't want Bigfoot hunters going around looking for this thing if we're really doing such good work trying to document it. So I know I packed a lot into that question, but I'll turn it over to Laurie here. Tell us about the location. You know, what can you tell us about it? And, you know, is there danger now that more word's getting out about it?
Well, I believe that they're in those mountains. I can go hiking in either direction of where my father lived in the Marble Mount area, and they're there in those mountains. That's where they live. And I believe they've been there for many, many years. In fact, I remember when Rettman Mullis drove Professor Brian Sykes with us to my location for the first time, and Rettman was sharing with me a story of a local who told him and a friend many years ago when he was in his 20s that all you have to do is go over there to those mountains, and that's where they live. And still, that's where they live.
What are these mountains, though? Without telling us, you know, the address,
in the North Cascade Mountains. In the North Cascade Mountains. There's a little town called Marble Mountain. That's where my father lives. Yes.
Okay. I didn't mean to put you on the spot there or something like that, but you know, there's people who are going to be listening that aren't going to believe a lot of this stuff, and they're going to need details. So it's like the more information we share with them that we can really solidify, the better. And
absolutely.
I'm fascinated because I...
Yeah, it's in the Cascades.
Okay. All right. So, Laurie, I guess it starts out with you know, Adam comes over, you guys have that really strange photograph situation, which we've explored it in depth with Adam before on the show, so we don't really need to get into it, although I am
actually,
just get your take on it. What do you think, what do you make of all that? Because you've had interaction with these creatures, but never that close.
Absolutely.
So what was your take on it? Do you think you were pushing things too far at that point?
Actually, this particular location is where my father took me to go fishing from the time I was 7 years old. So it's possible that the Squatches in that area do remember me. It's possible that they've watched me grow up to become a young lady. So I believe that. And when I went there and I went camping close by to one of my locations, I believe that because I've been establishing this trusting relationship with them, I believe that one of them did come down in to just take a look, to see what I looked like when I was sleeping. And I was very afraid when I saw that photo on the camera, the detailed of the muscle of his back structure. It terrified me. And I guess to me, when I go up there and I communicate with them, I can't think of it in my mind that they're this big, hairy monster, because it's too overwhelming for me to accept that anyways. But that,
Yeah. It's off-putting. No, I can imagine. So,
yeah.
So Dr. Sykes, he comes over to America first without Adam, and that's where you and him meet, and he goes and checks out this, and that's when he says to Adam, as Adam mentioned it earlier, that there was some thumping. It was underground, and it wasn't you. So what happened that led him to those conclusions? Tell me that story.
Well, Professor Redmond Mullis was actually giving Brian a ride up to this area, and he was going around meeting donors, and I had donated hair of my father's that he had found. And so I invited them both up to my father's area, one of the locations, and I thought, well, 90% they are going to have a truly amazing experience, because this is where the big guy is. And the big guy is the one who is loud, and he allows me to let him know that he's there when he's around. So we drove down into that area and walked a ways into the forest. And Professor Brian Sykes, he had his handheld recorder, and he was recording, just documenting events. And he heard the bumping coming from what appeared to be below this tree, and looked at my feet and saw that I didn't move. The sounds were not coming from Lori, clearly not coming from Redmond. And so drew his own conclusion that it's clearly something is going on here, but until we can come up with actual DNA facts, he can bump all he wants, but you know, we need to have a scientific expedition, as you call it. He wanted me to go back and continue to go back and collect as much DNA as I possibly could, so we could have it analyzed and tested in labs. So that's what we did. Yeah.
Right, right. We're faced with a challenge here. So for the folks, you know, who are listening, who think that we're,
absolutely,
you know, that Dr. Sykes, like punched a Bigfoot or something. Nothing like that happened. Nothing.
It was truly a challenge.
It's
not like the big guy is going to come out and let you swab him.
Right.
Oh, he's very
aggressive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's very aggressive, and I think it's worth talking about that later on, actually, Tim.
Well, yeah. I wanted to ask you about the underground aspect of this, because that was, I'm sure, you know, every idea about Bigfoot under the sun has been put forward in the past. So I'm sure this isn't the first time it's been proffered by somebody, but this is the first time that it's sort of crossed my radar, at least. And that's the idea that the Bigfoot are living underground. It seems like the interactions that you guys have had with the Bigfoot in the location, Lori's location, indicates that they're underground. I guess elucidate that more. Talk a little bit more about that. How is that even possible? Because that's a pretty big animal. I mean, how would it even exist underground? Adam, talk a little bit. We'll go to Adam here, because we don't want to have him feeling left out in the cold. Adam,
sure.
Adam, tell me about the underground aspect of this.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that you can't make general assumptions about what might happen with every Bigfoot in every particular area.
Mm.
So, and some of the research has to be assumptive, because you could study these things for the next 50 years. But so, the conclusions I draw are based on my observations in that area, which are very clear, and what. The noises that we all felt, all the witnesses who I was with over the period, were definitely coming, or seem to be coming from underground. We searched the area extensively. We couldn't find exits. So I cannot explain to you definitively why that would be the case. But they definitely were. There was no doubt about it. They seemed to be coming from underground. And so when this big... There's one particular creature, which we referred to as the big guy, and all of us did. And it was gave the most vigorous reaction. Most of the Bigfoots in that area are benign, and most of them must be. But not all of them are, and this particular one was extremely aggressive. And Laurie's dad, as my understanding, had said that this one was particularly aggressive. But the particularly aggressive one gave the most vigorous reaction.
Mm.
It was extremely hostile to me. But also, what it did do was bang extremely vigorously from underground, and there was no doubt about it. We all witnessed that. Now, how it does that, how it lives, how it cohabits, I have no idea. But I can tell you that there were other areas where there were other creatures living in that vicinity who also seemed to be emanating noises from underground. Do all Bigfoots do that in every part of the U.S.? Well, almost certainly not. They'll adapt to their own environments. Do they do that here? Yes, definitely they did.
Mm. And it sounds flummoxing in a way, too, because you mentioned in the book, we're kind of skipping ahead a little bit here, but I'm sort of honing in on the Bigfoot itself. That you looked around, you couldn't seem to find any entrance to sort of any underground, any sort of burrow or hole, which is really intriguing too.
No, I cannot explain it in any way, and nor could Brian, nor could Rhett, I would imagine, were they here, or Jared, or any of the other people, and there's been a number who have been there, and Laurie's taken many people. But because you can't necessarily explain it, it doesn't mean that's what, in all probability, it was. And from a number of independent witnesses, some of whom had absolutely no connection with one another, we all, I think, felt that the knocking or emanations, the interactions that Laurie specifically had with this creature were subterranean. It was definitely coming from a specific location, and that was where it seemed to reside. It almost seems, sometimes you have to swallow and say, it's very, very difficult to understand, but that is definitely what happened.
Now, I know you, Adam. Were you ever tempted to dig?
Yeah.
That was half
Actually,
a joke, half
I,
a joke.
I was.
Yeah, exactly.
I was.
Were you? Oh, my goodness.
I was. Yeah,
I'm just surprised because he has
Laurie
a temper.
Laurie wouldn't have let me, as you can
see. He has a temper. Comes out, he will come out. I just always feared for Adam's life because he, at times, was very aggressive. At times, the big guy is happy, but I feared that... the big guy just didn't really like Adam very much at times, and I always feared for Adam's life.
That comes across pretty clearly in the book. We've alluded to, we've talked about the big guy here a few times. I guess if Laurie and Adam and Dr. Brian Sykes are the three amigos, he's the El Guapo of the story. He's sort of the fourth big character. Laurie, you're the one who has the long-standing relationship with the big guy. Tell us
right.
about this creature, because it seems like it has a personality all of its own, and Adam sort of suggests in the book that perhaps it exists on its own, possibly, beyond a side, shunned, if you will, possibly, from sort of a larger community of Bigfoot. But tell me about the big guy.
Well, actually, I have discovered that over a course of As of 2010, summer of 2010 with my brother, I discovered that he's highly intelligent, he has an amazing memory, and I do believe that he is saddened by my father's passing. I have done a variety of studies with him each time that I have visited the big guy. And over the course of years, I have learned he's so highly intelligent, and I don't know for what extent that he does understand what I'm saying, but he does communicate with me, and it's just remarkable how much he does understand, and he does have feelings, and
Well, let me jump in here and sort of get you to paint a vivid picture here for the audience. You're talking about communicating with the big guy. How, you know, describe how this goes down. Because to the average listener right now, the idea of communicating with the Bigfoot is so exotic to them that they can't really wrap their minds around how it happens. So tell us how you're communicating with the Bigfoot, with the big guy.
Well, back in 2010, my brother and I, we went to one of the locations of my father, and there was a lot of activity, tree knocking, that sort of thing. And then this massive bumping sound, and I eventually got enough courage to go through the forest and wander around and find out where this is coming from, and it led me to this tree. And so that's where the big guy is. At this tree location down below, and I heard him growl from below my feet, and I have several recordings of this growl along with other sounds that is coming from below the tree location. And so the pounding of what is probably the inside walls from underneath the tree is probably some kind of a cove that he's inside of. And with his massive strength, you can hear from, oh goodness, quite a ways. We were like a half of a football field away, high up on the hillside, and we could still hear him pounding while he was inside his den. That's the massive strength he has. And no man could ever make the pounding sounds that the big guy can make. It's just not humanly possible.
So you've precluded, I'm sure there's sort of a skeptical bent out there that would ask if it's...
Well, absolutely, absolutely.
You know, maybe it's some kind of hermit or someone like a mountain man. Like you said, your dad was off the grid.
Right.
He was a mountain man. Maybe it's someone who, you know, went even further off the grid and decided they were going to live in the woods, and now they're they're just sort of feral.
Living
under
a tree.
Is that even possible?
Right.
No, and I think that's a good point. I think that's a good point. But you know, one of the things I wanted to do with the research that we did was come on a number of occasions, not just and random occasions as well. So obviously, on one occasion, for example, we turned up. On two occasions in the middle of the snow in February, wading into the snow, and nobody would have known we were coming, and we got that reaction, slowly. Nobody would have been living in under in that cabin in the snow, and also the behavioural patterns as well. Some of the noises that were emanated, particularly when it became extremely aggressive to me on one occasion when I was with Laurie, and it emanated a huge growl that could not have been generated by a person under any circumstance.
Yeah.
A roar.
So we got that cleared away.
Yes, absolutely. It was a roar, yes.
So we've kind of, and then beyond the big guy, is there also additional Bigfoot in the area? I believe so, based on what Adam said. You saw a Bigfoot.
Oh, yeah,
area,
there's
a
several.
Different Bigfoot.
I did. It was exciting, I'll tell you. It was one of the moments that I went to go check on the bait, and I'm saying bait because instead of my regular gift that I left the big guy, it was to obtain DNA, hair, saliva, fingerprint, and it was part of the research project, and Retman had went down with me, and as we were approaching the area where the big guy is, to my right, along the riverside area, I saw what to me appeared to be more of a young man's body frame, completely black, and I have to say covered with fur because I could only see the outline and not, you know, of a person. And he looked at me, and the way his stand was, like, he was stopped in his tracks. He was walking like a male would walk and stopped in his tracks, looked at me. I'm looking at him, and I dropped my left leg and just kind of leaned to the left, and I'm I'm looking at him, he's looking at me, and then he was gone. I think he just hid behind the large tree, the large Douglas fir tree he was next to, but it was just so quick. He was there, and he was gone. And so then I mentioned to Rettman, I just saw one over there, and I'm pointing to my right.
Wow.
And at the moment, it was very eerie because it was at dusk, and we're walking into the forest. And
yeah, that would
I already had an eerie feeling. Yes, yes.
That would freak me out. Okay, so we've kind of established, I think we've established the foundation here of the story. And Dr. Sykes comes out, he senses, he gets a feel for this communicative session that's going on between you and the big guy, and he seems like he's on board here. And then he comes back and he approaches Adam, and Adam, pick it up from here. You guys go back to America for this secret expedition. What I thought was interesting, and you pointed out, you were very excited about when we talked about it, he actually got a lot of help from the local government in a lot of ways. He got some research permits. He got some a leg up, if you will, from various authorities, all on the down low, which I thought was really interesting, but all really promising that they were so supportive of this. So I guess enlighten people into the help that you guys got from, you know, the folks in the Fisheries
true.
And Wildlife
so
Department.
Amazing.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that we'd established from looking into that area and doing that research is that this was the most active subject. So there are a number of these Bigfoot creatures, or this is an assumption that I'm making in this area, but the one that was most active was this one that Laurie had got a reaction from, that the research had happened in that way, and we were clearly getting results. It was taking apples and things like that. When Laurie put them down for it, it could communicate with her on a very basic level. So, but the important thing is getting, the thing I'm always after is getting scientific evidence. Now, in order for Brian to study those things, in order to get samples and have them analyzed, he needed a research permit. So, as my understanding is, he got the first ever Bigfoot research permit to do scientific research. And I said to him, you know, what does it look like? And we were having a bit of a joke, and he says, well, it's not a bloody scroll, Adam, it's just an email, you know?
Yeah.
It's not in parchment or anything, do you know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
And he was working with Wildlife and Fisheries at Oregon. Now, one of the most basic and fundamental rules of forensics is that, you know, forensics won't analyze something if you are wishing to be an advocate. Yeah, so they won't. If you're trying to set your point of view up, then by that very nature you negate it because you're not objective, and the person who's doing the analysis is objective. So Brian had to do, but again, there was that unique opportunity to work with Wildlife and Fisheries there because of who Brian was. He could use their labs. So if And when we did get samples, they would be subsequently taken there and examined in those labs. And if necessary, those samples would be sent back to Oxford, where Brian is a don at university there. So Laurie's import in that sense, and Laurie's is the emotional connection, the family connection, that feeling of having that research there and being proud of it. Brian's connection is the objective scientific. Well, if we're going to find anything that's substantive, it needs to be done this way. And he had spent some time with being taught forensics there, so the site was approached in a forensic manner, and there were certain protocols you had to follow. So, for example, any of the samples that were gathered, just without going into rattling on about forensics for too long, any of the samples the jars would have to be sterilized. Before and after photographs would have to be taken, gloves were taken, sound noises were taken, any video recording that we were doing would all have to be documented. And, you know, in some of those instances, Brian was super methodical and extremely professional, even when it could be quite aggressive. So I remember one time it was banging extremely loudly after there was a particular incident where, in my opinion, it threatened Laurie and I very aggressively the day before. And he's talking into his recorder, and he's going, you know, and then here we are at the site, Adam and I are at the site, we're doing X, Y, and Z, and I was thinking, just bloody hurry up, let's just get these samples and bugger off, because we're worried we're going to kick off. You know, yeah, it was volatile.
I remember watching that video.
Now, I don't want to, like, put words in Sykes's mouth here, but did he come out of this whole thing sort of like a believer that there was this Bigfoot lurking in the mountains? Where, you know, did he come out of this like, yeah, guys, you're onto something here, that we're really there's something here.
Well, that's why he wanted to conduct the Big Guy Project, because as a scientist, you only have one opportunity. Sometimes you just have to take it. And he felt that this was his opportunity. And he felt that if the big guy was going to leave, if we thought for a moment the big guy was going to leave, he would come over to America and conduct the Big Guy Project with us sooner, because of it being such an amazing opportunity to prove
right.
the Bigfoot does exist. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, he was also very keen on getting, but again, you can have an opinion, but it doesn't matter. Opinions are irrelevant in the sense that you know, he was so persuaded that he funded me to go out there.
Right.
And I think that that's important to state. But of course, he realizes that that you need that objective evidence, which is obviously what it was about. And he felt that the thing was very dangerous. We had some amusing times, but we also had some times when we thought, well, actually, it's quite dangerous. I remember when the day after the incident with Laurie and I, where it growls very, very severely, I remember him sort of, we parked up the car and we were walking down to this area. I remember him saying to me, well, look, this is how you work the car if anything happens to me. And I was thinking, well, I'm not leaving you here. I was saying to him, you know, I'll drag you back, blah, 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 just in case it does attack. And so...
And he was serious, right? He wasn't just joking around.
He was serious. But also, he could, you know, he was very, very serious. That was how we felt about it. But also, there was some very humorous moments. So
yeah.
It was Laurie's idea one time to put down a marker. So she had a scarf, and she wore this scarf. Deliberately dropped it. And what the idea was, that we'd climb up a hill and look from the hill at a point of elevation where we could see this area where the thing was with a camera, and see if it came out to get the scarf. And it was wise to it. And we got up to this on top of the hill, and it starts banging away. So you know, in mock joking thing, he says to it, he goes, "This is your last bloody chance, you bloody thing. You damn well come out now. You know I'm a bloody scientist." You know,
it was like, "This is your one chance. This is your opportunity." Because we were trying to capture him on film, and there was no trick in the big guy. It was like he knew we were up to no good, and it didn't work. Our plan didn't work.
Very elusive in that sense. Now, tell me about these. So, I guess what kind of stuff were you doing on the expedition to try and get more information? Tell me about specifically the food situation. You guys are you're giving it food in the attempts of what? Garnering some DNA evidence through that?
Yeah, what we're trying to do is get hair samples off it. So Laurie talk about this in more detail, but Laurie had left apples out for it for a while, because they're actually native species, and seeing what would happen and seeing whether they'd be taken by it. And then we tried a couple of other things, really, to see if we could get hair samples. So we set up hair traps in the area, and the idea is to use those hair traps to get the hair so we can analyze the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what this is all about. So it's about getting the DNA. One interesting observation, and obviously I'll let Laurie talk about that, with the couple of experiments I tried. So I wrapped a boiled egg at one stage in tissue paper to see if it would show manual dexterity and opposable thumbs. And it unwrapped the whole egg, ate the egg whole as an entity, and left the wrapper unscathed. And the last observational point I'd make, and then I'll obviously let Laurie talk about this because she did more of it, was that We left food samples out in a number of locations. The specific ones taken were taken in this particular vicinity where the big guy was. We left other samples only a few hundred yards away, some of which were visible from this location, and they were not taken. They were completely untouched, even though they were only a few hundred yards away. So you can make all sorts of assumptions about territory, about how they might socially behave. They are, I mean, these are all speculations, but they are, this is, you know, it was very, very interesting. And I could talk about that just for an hour, but I'll let Laurie talk about the samples as well.
Well, basically, because I was the one with the established relationship with the big guy and the family around, is it was my job to set up the bait. And so I did the gifting as I always would. I would always go in, say hello, do my greeting, and I would leave the bait. And this for me was rather difficult, to go from habituation and establishing this trusting relationship, carrying on my father's research, to turning and doing things in more of a scientific way. And I felt like I was tricking the big guy, because really that's what I was doing. It wasn't just a gift. I was leaving him something so he would leave me a fingerprint, so he would catch his hair on it, and I was tricking him. And so that was difficult for me, but I did it anyways. And it's truly amazing what we have in the labs today. I know that they like chocolate, and so a wrapper of a Hershey's chocolate bar, just the wrapper alone, you can get a fingerprint from, even though it rained, or a glass, even though it rained. You could throw a glass jar into the ocean, and you can still obtain the fingerprint of who threw that glass jar into the ocean. It's just absolutely amazing. And so those were the kind of things that we were doing. And so at one point, I had left, you know, Hershey's chocolate, his favorite, and so forth, trying to obtain DNA.
Now, I guess, the obvious question is, what kind of stuff did you manage to get through these series of experiments? So we talked, did we get any hair samples? Did we get any fingerprint stuff? Did we get any evidence to come out of the expedition?
I think the short answer to that is nothing tangible, no, which is disappointing. Mm. But, you know, in a way that shows that a lot of the conclusions have to be assumptive. I mean, there are some amazing firsts, the first ever Bigfoot research permit. The fact that a world-leading geneticist was prepared to do this research and to be sufficiently interested in it on that level. But in terms of quantifiable data that can be independently scientifically corroborated, well, the answer to that is a short no. We didn't succeed in doing that. And that's a damn shame. but that's the reality of the situation. You have to be prepared to say that. There's no point flowering that up. You either did or you didn't, and the answer is didn't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I respect your honesty. You could, you know, It's still a landmark expedition. Now, why didn't you? You said that sometimes he takes the food. Have you considered setting up some game cameras on the food, or does he just not take the food when they're being when the potential to be filmed comes up?
Adam, you should answer that one.
Yeah, well, I've already. I mean, that was one of the first things I did when I first got there.
Oh, okay.
And it didn't work.
Exactly.
It didn't work.
It didn't work. He won't take the food.
And I even put a glass jar down very close to it, with a hidden trail cam, with these green apples in, which are indigenous to that part of Washington, to see if it would come and take that, and it wouldn't go anywhere near the trail camera. Wouldn't have it at all. It wouldn't fall, because that was Brian's first thought. He said to me, well, it should be fairly easy to, you know, before he went there, he said, well, it should be fairly easy. All we need to do really is stick up a trail camera and stick some bait down.
Right, exactly.
And I was like, well, yeah, I've thought of that.
Yeah.
It's been done. It doesn't happen.
It was done a while ago, that.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. See, because that goes to my intrinsic point, and my ultimate thing is, and always has been, the thing that I'm most fascinated about this, as opposed to, you know, I've looked for the Yeren in China, I've looked for the Amas in Mongolia, I've looked for these things in Russia, I've been all over the place looking for these things, and they never troubled me in the sense that I did think that there was evidence for these creatures in other parts of the world, but I could fairly plausibly think, well, what might be the orang pendek? It might be a symbol of something. It might be, you know, a pygmy orangutan. There was something that, you know, this lured to walk bipedally. In other words, there was something I could explain about that, which made that scientifically plausible and also very interesting. But there was never a level of sophistication. But with the thing about this Bigfoot and the thing about this, the thing that intrigued me most, and the thing that this is the mystery that I want solved, was its level of intellect. And so Laurie's touched on the intellect there, and it seems to me, of all the creatures that may or may not exist of these man-beasts, the Bigfoot is undoubtedly the most intelligent and or sophisticated, because it displays a level of behavior and cognitive abilities that seem far superior to anything else I've ever looked for. So that fascinates me.
Right, right. It seems definitely, just from reading the book, that it's like, You're dealing in a whole different, no pun intended for the interdimensional folks, but you're dealing with like a whole different dimension of creature here with this Bigfoot. It seems the other animals you're searching for seem more like animals. This thing seems more like, I don't know, like a missing link, like something between an animal and a human. But by the way that it seems to be a lot more interactive it's far more interactive with you guys than say when you're going looking for the orang pendek.
Yeah, absolutely, and the displays of emotion are what interest me. There's a certain sort of familial relationships. I mean, and also the thing that some of the experiments
like my father's
are repeatable.
Tapes.
So yeah.
Exactly.
The big guy,
he remembers his voice. It's truly amazing.
Yeah.
You can tell he feels sadness.
Yeah, explain to the audience what we're talking about with your father's tapes.
Okay, so we tried an exercise. We were trying to get the big guy to wake up and respond to us. And so I thought, Adam's like, hey, Lori, play your father's tape. That always gets a reaction out of him. So I thought, okay, you want me to play my dad's tapes? And play his audio? And he bumped once. Once is yes. That I've known is once is yes, hello, goodbye, okay, I understand. And so I play it, and my father's talking, and then he starts to, he did like this low guttural growl and in response to what my father was talking about. And it's just truly amazing. It's like he understood what my father was saying. And he shows true emotion of when he hears my father's voice. At one point in time, I went up there with, kind of going off track a little bit, but I went up there with a friend of mine, and I played my father's audio tape for the very first time, and I heard a roar, and we hurried back to the car, and we were afraid, and I thought, no, I came up here to play my father's tape for the first time in the forest. I just want to know if he remembers my dad, if I'm going to get some kind of a reaction. How intelligent is he, you know? And so I played my father's audio tape, and it was like complete silence. And where he was bumping and throwing a fit and had growled, and I played my father's audio tape, and it was peaceful. And he was listening to my father's voice for the very first time in 6 months, and that has got to stand for something. So it's truly amazing that they are so intelligent.
When you're communicating with it, are you like right at the tree that it's under, or are you kind of, you know, how close are you to where you think it may be, you know, relative to the ground and everything?
I go to the tree. Yeah. There's the moments like right now I'm still working on my fear. And before I was carefree spirit wandering around in the forest and would talk to the big guy and leave him apples and he'd bump on the ground. And I'm working on my fear because of the big guy project and the roar, the fear of death in me, that moment.
Yeah, we've alluded to this a few
moment.
Times.
Now I have to work on my fear again. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
we've alluded to it a few times, I guess. Adam,
exactly.
You're our resident
yeah.
extreme expedition storyteller. So tell the story in total here about this roar that seems based on what Lori's telling me, it almost was kind of like a sea change in a lot of ways for this whole project, for this whole experience. It sounded like whatever happened in that moment made you all kind of rethink what exactly you're doing here. So tell that story.
Well,
exactly.
the thing about the big guy is that it has a hair trigger temper, and it did not like the fact that, well, it seemed to. This is not like the fact that Laurie and I were in a relationship, and it became more aggressive towards me in particular because of that. So there was a time when Laurie brings up people, individuals. To that specific location and sort of introduces them and gets this interaction. And I remember in February was the first time I brought my friend Jared, who's a producer for Nat Geo, and his friend Ray, who's a dentist, and Laurie would bring him up and say, oh, this is Ray, this is Jared. And then he said, oh, and Adam's here. And the moment he said Adam's here, he went, roar! Which was just bizarre, and I remember it. And that was when Ray... And it's in the book, Ray says, you know, just so you know, big guy, Adam's the one in camouflage. He's definitely the one in camouflage, you know.
Yeah,
that's right.
About it. Now, on this specific occasion, so before Brian had come, he'd obviously funded me to go out, and I was concerned that it would still be there, this thing. Because, you know, the guys paid for me to come out, and I was thinking, oh, shit, you know, is it still going to be there? There's no guarantee. It's a bloody wild animal. You could have buggered off, and that would have been it, you know. But also he wanted us to set up the hair traps and all that lot before he arrived. So we went down and we'd set some up. And then the idea was that we'd go down past it the next day, and we bought some fishing rods. So we'd go down to the river and pretend to fish to see if it had come out, and I'd try and make a snapshot of it, see if we could draw it out. But the moment we got to the area where it was, it roared that loudly. It was like, you know when I've been in the jungle and stuff like that before, and there are other wild animals, and you can hear them in the distance. I've not been that close to them, but I heard tigers roar before. But I imagined it was like a tiger was roaring right, you know, 6 feet from me. And it so upset Laurie that she was unable to go back on that occasion, and we had to drive out of that area, and she was shaken up. I remember her shaking, and she wouldn't go back the next day. And it was really extremely unpleasant. And from my own point of view, I remember that night Laurie wasn't going back. I was going with Brian. I remember we're in this little town in the middle of nowhere and there's no one around. It was quiet. I remember having a glass of wine and just being outside having this glass of wine, thinking, you know what, shit, I'm not sure whether, you know, tomorrow it might actually come out and rip me to pieces.
Yeah.
And that was a genuine thought I had. It was a genuine thought I had. And I remember when I was walking down towards it, we said goodbye to Laurie, and Brian and I went down. And I remember thinking, you know what, I'm not sure whether I'm going to come back today. And that was when we had that conversation I alluded to earlier about, I mean, you know, whether it was actually going to really go for us. I want to emphasize that I don't think most of them are like that. But I think in any species, there are ones that are more aggressive than others. You can see that with your own family, cats and dogs, yeah? Or with apes in other areas. With people, there are shit houses and there are nice people, you know?
Exactly.
This is an interesting subject to study because it gives such acute reactions. And so as a study subject, it was perfect. The other ones in the vicinity were much more timid and wouldn't even take samples. This one was much bolder and was prepared to do so. But it had that extremis of reaction, which is interesting, from an observational point of view, from an anthropological point of view. So it wanted to interact with Laurie on a you know, it had that emotional reaction with Laurie.
He does.
It had that relationship.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting.
The converse of that is it hated me because of the relationship I had with her. So you were able to see both spectrums of its emotional behavior with the two people there at the same time.
Yeah. And that's not, like you said, it's not particularly unsurprising from an animal if it builds a strong bond with a person, you know? So it sounds perfectly reasonable if you really think about it. Now, it's interesting that the level of... the depth of this relationship that Laurie's developed with the big guy, because it speaks to what I've talked about a couple times with Lauren Coleman on the show. He suggests sort of like a Diane Fossey, model for studying the Bigfoot, where we need a woman to sort of go into the environment and develop a relationship with the creature, which is exactly what seems to have taken place here. So
that's
great.
What I've done. Exactly.
To think about.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think I heard that.
They really
that
like my voice. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They like the way that I talk to them. And I'll talk to the big guy. Like, he's this cute little puppy dog or something. He loves it. It's so amazing. But I just have to make a comment when about Adam, what he was just talking about. It's true. That day that Adam and Brian were going back to collect all the samples, everything, and it was our last day. I was sitting in the hotel room, and I was waiting for them. And if they took too long, I was supposed to call the ranger to go get help, not knowing if they were going to come back alive. And I was so terrified. And I went from establishing this relationship with the big guy, my father's discovery, to trying to prove the big guy exists and pissing him off. That's what I did. I made him very angry. And so then I did actually go back up there with Dr. Matthew Johnson, and I made peace with the big guy after he roared and I thought I was going to be dead. And so now it continues on.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure whether you could ever make peace with it.
I don't know.
I think they have a very volatile temperament, and I think the idea of you know, most of them were benign, but I think that Lauren's point, if I just backtrack slightly about women researchers and the pheromones, I heard what Lauren had to say, and I agreed with him, and I was thinking, well, you know, I'll be able to talk about this, because what he predicted in that sense was absolutely what happened. He didn't know about this, obviously, at the time, so he was talking without the knowledge of that, which makes his observation more pertinent, I think.
Exactly.
Because he didn't know, and yet what he said was absolutely right. In this instance, that was exactly what happened. The woman there, who was non-threatening, there wasn't an alpha male behavior, with a particular pheromones, was able to build a relationship with this thing, which solicited reactions which you would not have got if you were a man. The reactions I got were at the other end of the spectrum, the very aggressive ones, because I was the alpha male to it, the threat to it. And so what it displayed to me was, by and large, an unending aggression and resentment. But from an observational point of view, that was extremely interesting. So you could see the... it wanted to bump for Laurie. So Laurie would say, you know, as you said, she talks in that cute puppy dog thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where bang, 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 you know, you're a puppy dog and all that. And it would bang, bang, bang back three or four times. So it would directly repeat the amount of knocks that Laurie made and do that. And that was very easy to observe. But, you know, if I was there and it saw me getting close to her, it would bloody growl. So,
right.
that was very, very true. And I think with this particular one, I really don't think you could ever get a response. It has a very hair trigger temper. I don't think you could ever be in a situation where it wouldn't be potentially aggressive. As I say, 99% of them, I'm sure, are not. But this one is particularly dangerous, I think.
He's almost, dare I say, domesticated in a way, or at least he's got a relationship with a human that many, many Bigfoot probably don't have. That's obviously incredible speculation on my part, but you know, give me that at least. But it seems it stands to reason that most Bigfoot don't have human friends. So the fact that he seems to, for lack of a better term, be friends with you changes the whole dynamic of it. But it opens the door
for
what you guys are doing with Dr. Sykes in a huge way. This is like the breakthrough that we may have been waiting for years.
Well, exactly, because it was bold and it was able to do that, because that Laurie's relationship had been built up, it was prepared to take risks. So it was able to solicit those reactions. So we were able to concentrate in that specific locale with the objective, and this always has to be the objective, of getting independent data which you can corroborate. So that has to be what it's about, always in these particular instances.
Now, we established that the big guy didn't like you, Adam. What did he think of Dr. Sykes? Was he was he nonplussed by his credentials?
No, he seemed happy. Actually, he seemed happy when Brian was there. Didn't you think, Adam?
Well, I don't think he was threatened by Brian, but then
he
wasn't in the same relationship, as I was.
As us. Exactly.
It wasn't the same sort of relationship, which is interesting. So it would bump away, and when we were gathering samples, it would display that sort of behaviour. But it wasn't, it didn't seem to have the same level of aggression to anybody else, as far as I can remember, as it did towards me.
Yeah,
I remember. Brian, as a professor, looking around the tree, looking for hairs, as a scientist would. And the big guy bumping away, and it just sounded like he was happy. Brian was there. And I'm thinking, hurry up before he gets upset. And it was fine.
Yeah, he was fine with them. An interesting question, because, a lot of the people are titillated by the fact that Dr. Sykes was on this trip. What was he doing? You're putting out the samples, you're waiting and hoping that something's going to turn up. What kind of stuff were you doing on this expedition? Because, I've heard about all your expeditions before, Adam, where you're, you're going through the jungle, you're looking for prints, you're looking for hair. Is that kind of what you were doing with Dr. Sykes during this time in the location?
Basically, we're setting down – he was obviously working with wildlife and fisheries. So he got those scientific permits. We were setting up hare traps primarily and putting down food bait, if you like, to get those hare traps. And they would be often in jars. So the idea was that it would have to reach in to get foodstuffs, and we were hoping to get hairs and or fingerprints on the jars, which could subsequently be analysed. So that was basically what we were doing. And observing that forensic protocol, which I talked about earlier on, which is you take a photograph before, you take a photograph after. He's commenting in a dictaphone about what we observed on the day, and Laurie had been doing that for a number of years before that. So everything has to be documented before and after. Everything's taken away. Everything's not touched, and everything's analysed subsequently in a lab. And so that was the basic protocol. And at night, what we'd do is we hired a little place, and at night we'd bring the samples back, and we'd have a look in the microscope and have a little bit of chat about what we'd done that day, and sort of plan the next day around the events and talk about best times to go. So it certainly seemed that the thing was, and again, this is assumptive on my part, it was much more difficult to solicit any sort of reaction in the morning initially. It was less responsive. So, but by late afternoon, that was the most responsive time. It was more like you were more likely to get more vigorous reactions as the day wore on. So it was learning. It was compiling data. And as I say, from an anthropological point of view, you could study it for around 30 years and still make assumptions. But these are just very, very thumbnail sketches, Tim.
Yeah. It's interesting. Now, this all went down in May of 2013.
Yes.
And considering that was all kept under wraps, perhaps you can't say much else. But, I mean, we're talking about a year and a half. What's gone on since then? Have you, Laura, you said you made peace with the big guy, you returned there, but have there been any other sort of formal expeditions to the area to look into this, or is it kind of all in a holding pattern right now until God knows what something else develops?
Well, I really don't know where I go from here. So.
I think the point that I would make about these sort of things is that now we are getting scientists to engage in these sort of programs.
Hmm.
And what these sort of things merit is not to Lauren's point. Lauren made a point again about documentaries,
right?
And how they might work on when he was on your show. Was it September? He was on your show, Tim.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Often they can be just a few days here and then you go. So, for example, he talked about when I went to Mongolia. In fact, I went there for 3 weeks, the camera crew, and I paid for myself. I saved up for 2 years to go. But the camera crew were only there for a few days, and then they left. The sort of really meritorious research in these sort of things would be if you spent a considered amount of time in a particular area like this, observed scientific protocols, and did some concentrated research. And if you're asking what I would like to see, in relation to this area, in relation to some other areas that may have scientific merit, is that sort of concentrated research. But it's all a question of funding. You know, Brian paid for that himself, and he's on limited funds. I pay for a lot of my research myself, you know. I can often save up for years to go on one trip.
Right.
What this needs is concentrated academic research where you can spend a considerable amount of time and concentrate on doing that. So you can get, hopefully, that objective, independent scientific evidence that can be independently corroborated and repeated. That's what you're after. Because what you're increasingly seeing is people who are credible scientists who are at least prepared to accept the notion that these creatures may exist. And if they're prepared to accept the notion, they're prepared to indulge in this research. But you can't just do it on, you know, I came here and I filmed for a few days and then I buggered off.
Right.
It needs to be concentrated. And if you do that, you could well get results.
Hmm.
You know, I am of the view that if you were to do this in this particular area, you would get those results. And there are a number of people who've witnessed this behavior and the behavioral patterns rather than substantive data. Then you'd get that. And I don't think it would be hugely hard to extract. You would just, all you need is some decent hair samples. That's what you need. And if you can evidence that, then that would be phenomenal. And that, I think, would be the tipping point. You know, we've often talked about whether you need a body, and I'm not an advocate of killing these things. I don't think that that's the right approach in any way. But I do know that they exist. And I do know that because they have physical properties, their flesh, they consume things, they have hair, then there, ergo, you must be able to get that hair and you must be able to analyze it. And that's what all of us were of the view of doing, and that's what our objectives are.
Hmm.
So a lot of the emotional stuff is fascinating observational and social behavior, but you need a concentrated, sophisticated project with credible scientists, and that's what you need to bring to the table. And by doing this research, I hope that it becomes an important stepping stone so that can happen, because there is this marvelous potential, which isn't a fanciful notion, which is a credible research, which can take you on that next step. And that's really, really what needs to happen here.
Right, right. Well, that's the, I guess, I don't want to say confusing part, but that's the sort of part that leaves me hanging here as I finish the book and, you know, hear the story. It's like, if I was Dr. Sykes, I'd be there, you know, I would have gone
exactly.
back by now. So I'm a little confused, I guess, why he hasn't. Unless, of course, he's a very busy man. He's kind of like an academic celebrity at this point. So he can't really up and do these sort of things on a whim all the time. But still, I mean, it seems like this thing is ripe for more, and I'm surprised that more hasn't happened since then, unless, you know, more has happened and we haven't been told about it yet, in which case I totally would understand. But I mean, I think you see where I'm coming from, right?
It comes down to money. So, for example, you know, if I collect samples, So I went to a number of different places this year, and I collect samples, and I had some of the experiences I'd learned, for example, in the Cascades with the grunting, I was able to emulate this year. And there's a very, very well-known one, which I did at the Olympic Project, where I was able to grunt and get grunts back at Derek Randall's place. And a number of people observed those, some of which I'd never met or heard of before. But what I was doing was emulating directly the grunts I'd heard in the Cascades.
Hmm.
And when I had an interaction, when Laurie and I had been there, and several of them had interacted with us, and I'd heard those grunts, and I was able to emulate them. So what you're doing is you're building up a pattern of behavior. But, when I was gathering those samples, and Todd Distel did the analysis of the samples this year, Brian's point, well, who's going to fund this? If we get samples and if we get them analyzed, then that's, over $1,000 per DNA sample for them to be properly run through, and somebody's got to pay for that. That's why I come back to that point. You need that funding.
Yeah.
He's an individual. You'd need a research grant for that to happen. You'd need that money. If I was a wealthy man, I would fund that. I'd be funding that research. But,
absolutely.
I'm not a wealthy man.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I drive an old banger and spend my spare cash on going on expeditions. And there's only so far, with respect to me and Laurie and everybody else, amateur researchers like ourselves who can take these things. That's where credible scientists need to come in and take over and do these studies.
Well,
so, and take it that forward.
Yeah. And in doing this research, I had truly hoped that we would have obtained the DNA that we needed. And this area, my father's, his area was going to be protected within a 40-mile radius and properly studied. And that's really what I wanted to have happen. I wanted them to have a protected area of their own. I wanted that. So.
Well, it's still possible.
Hopefully someday it will happen. Yeah.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?